Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm your host, Albert Morales, and this morning's conversation is with Vice Admiral Adam Robinson, Surgeon General of the U.S. Navy. Also joining us in our conversation from IBM is Tom Romeo. Admiral, it's been said that traumatic brain injury, or TBI, is considered the signature injury of the Iraq War. First, could you just take a moment and describe what constitutes TBI? And second, would you tell us about research in TBI prevention, assessment, and treatment, and how prevalent is it among your sailors and Marines?
TBI, traumatic brain injury, is a insult to the brain, which is usually caused by a blast and a pressure gradient difference between the outside of the head and the inside of the head. There is a great deal of difference in the mechanism of injury and perhaps in how you diagnose and even how you treat those injuries. Most of the data that we have had is based on traumatic injuries that have occurred with what we call contra-coup injuries from hitting your head. And now we're having to deal with that pressure gradient and that actually blast effect that has a different mechanism of injury in the brain itself. Understanding how to diagnose traumatic brain injuries and who has a traumatic brain injury has really been very problematic. We have thought that only people who are unconscious have traumatic brain injuries. And what we're finding is state of consciousness is not necessarily a determinant. Distance from the blast itself may not be a determinant. It may be a variety of different things that we have to take into question and to take into consideration as we make the diagnosis of traumatic brain injuries. Probably the best way of making the diagnosis is to do cognitive assessments of someone before they go into a conflict and then do the same cognitive assessment of them after they have been introduced or been involved in a blast or been involved in some sort of injury. We're learning that there are numbers of people that have traumatic brain injuries that we've never listed before. I'll give you the RAND study that says of the 1.6 million men and women who have been in combat theater operations, perhaps up to 20% of them may be involved with traumatic brain injuries. And the key here is that it is a rampant disorder that needs to be dealt with, and it's the type of disorder that can be very, very subtle, and it may be very difficult to detect. Usually, you're not going to be aware of it as much as perhaps a wife or a husband or a mother or father, some other loved one that knows you well may be aware of it. So it's one of those insidious disorders that needs to be treated appropriately.
Along similar lines, Admiral, in some of the previous segments, we talked a little bit about psychological and mental health. Given operational tempo and the stress it places on service members, what is Navy medicine doing in the area of mental health? Specifically, could you elaborate on the programs in place to diagnose, prevent, and treat service members in this area?
Well, the combat operational stress care that we're doing now, the COSC, and the operational stress that we're doing across the theater is very important. The first thing is it's absolutely a leadership initiative. My leadership on the Navy side and my leadership on the Marine Corps side have taken full responsibility for caring for our sailors and Marines and trying to prevent operational stress. It starts from recruit camp and it goes all the way through War College. Leadership is absolutely important in terms of talking to people, of destigmatizing the need for mental health care, of letting people know that, as Heidi Kraft has stated so eloquently in her book, Rule Number Two, rule number one is war hurts people. And rule number two is you have the invisible injuries of war, which are psychological, emotional, and I think spiritual injuries that have to be attended to also. Operational stress control is a formal method of trying to make sure that we remember rule number one, rule number two, and then we provide the care that people need, the mental health, the emotional health, and the spiritual health, which then means that we have our mental health professionals, our psychiatrists, our psychologists, our licensed clinical social workers, and we also have our chaplains who are there and who are talking and embedded with our men and women in their units on a day-to-day basis so that they can have the mental health capability from the very first day, and if need be, they can be sent back to have further and more intense therapy.
Thank you, Admiral. I'd like to shift gears a little bit. I know that the Navy is also very heavily involved in research, and research is at the heart of nearly every major medical and pharmaceutical treatment advancement. Can you tell us about Navy Medicine's research and development efforts, and specifically, what work is being done by the Naval Medical Research Center's Biological Defense Research Directorate and the Naval Health Research Center? Do those labs play in the worldwide monitoring of new emerging infectious diseases, such as the avian influenza?
The Navy's research efforts, particularly in the form of infectious disease, is second to no one's. As a matter of fact, two particular vaccines, which are now being tested, and by the way, Army has played very heavily in these vaccines also, but two are malaria and HIV. So both of those research vaccines, neither one has been approved. They're both in the research stage, but both of those have, in fact, come along, and that's with the diligent efforts of our researchers and our infectious disease experts. We've partnered with the Indonesian government in particular and with other governments from the Asian community to look and to review samples of patients that are thought to have avian influenza, and there's been a great deal of effort placed on trying to not only develop a screen for that particular disease, but also to develop a vaccine for that disease. Now, I'm going to shift on research and also tell you two things. The ability to have first-rate medical education in the military is dependent upon having the type of medical research that's being done at Walter Reed and at Navy Medical Research Commands. And it's not just infectious disease. It's actually a broad spectrum of bench research, and that's very critical to having a strong medical department. And the second is the clinical research that needs to get done from our medical centers. The research community in the military and in the Navy has always been very heavily involved in both fundamental bench research and also the clinical research that we can translate into ways and methods to care for our patients on a daily basis.
It would seem that collaboration with your federal healthcare partners is essential to providing quality care to returning wounded warriors. Would you tell us about your efforts to increase collaboration in resource sharing, new facility construction, and joint ventures with the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs?
Presently, the Navy and DVA, Department of Veterans Affairs, have gone together to open up a joint medical facility in North Chicago called the James Lovell Medical Clinic in North Chicago. It's a way of bringing together and partnering with our Department of Veterans Affairs, which has a large veterans hospital there, the Navy, which has had a large naval hospital there. It will be run by a Department of Veterans Affairs hospital administrator. The second in command will be a Navy chief operating officer. It will have both Department of Veterans Affairs and Naval medical officers and dentists and healthcare professionals, and it will care for not only our recruit command, but also those individuals that are serving in the North Chicago area that may be eligible for care. So it's a way of partnering and sharing resources. We have another facility at Pensacola, Florida, not nearly as far along in the development as in North Chicago, but still very promising and doing very well. And we also have another agreement in Guam between the Department of Veterans Affairs and the new Naval Hospital that we're building there. The key to success for the future is to take our wounded warriors, who we will have a lifetime commitment to care for, to partner with Department of Veterans Affairs, to partner with DOD, and then to take those two great institutions and marry them together so that we can provide care for our wounded warriors that we will have to do in the future. The key here is that in 2012 or 2015, long after I'm retired, there are going to still be men and women who have been injured in this conflict who are going to need care. They're going to need care in 2025. 2035. So I tell my people constantly, the reflection of how good we are and the reflection of how good our nation's promises to our wounded warriors is, how are they doing in 2040 and 2045 and 2050, long after this conflict is over, but needing that care no less?
That's great. Thank you. Admiral, I only have about another minute, but I do want to get to a question around some of the challenges that perhaps you face around end strength targets for medical personnel. What steps have you taken to address some staffing shortfalls and attract personnel staff, and what challenges still remain in this area?
Well, there are multiple challenges to shortfalls, and the largest one we have today, it's not the only one, but it's the largest, is mental health professionals. There's no way around that. And, you know, if there's an elephant in the living room, it's mental health professionals. I need psychiatrists. I need psychologists. I need licensed clinical social workers. I need psychiatric nurse practitioners. I need psychiatric techs. I need occupational therapists. I need those people that can do that function. We don't have enough of them. From the Navy point of view, the Navy made some decisions years ago, and I'm saying years ago, I was in the Navy at the time. I remember when the decisions were made. I think they were the wrong decisions, and I'll own that to say we thought that we didn't need as many uniformed social workers and as many uniformed psychologists as we now know that we do need. And we're trying to correct that by looking at our requirements, and the way we do end strength in the military is you have to look at the requirements. And it's a requirements-based process. So you have to go back to ground zero, look at requirements, look at what you think you need in uniform, and then address that formally in our POM process. And I'm getting technical now, but in the way that we, in fact, get money and personnel is through a process. And we have to look way ahead, usually a five-year model, and we have to hope that we are correct because usually the decisions we made in 2009 and 10 often won't be reflected completely until 2015 or 16 in terms of where we are within strength and where we are with capability. In that regard, we're relooking at our requirements for the professionals that I've talking about, as well as several other professionals. But the key here is we have to make sure that we have those people that are available and willing to come into our all-volunteer medical services, Army, Navy, and Air Force. As I said before, we all three services are competing with one another, and I think DOD Health Affairs, Dr. Cassell's and the people who are at Health Affairs are looking at policies to make that competition less and let us share more. We have to look at Department of Veterans Affairs, who's also competing with us, and of course, we have to look at the private sector, who is also competing with us. So there are a multitude of different agencies and different institutions that we're competing with. But this is what we have to do in terms of a necessity for the future. I think that end strength is going to be reflected in the fact that as the Marine Corps grows and the Marines go nowhere from an operational point of view without Navy medicine, Navy medicine and Navy has to also grow commensurately. And when I say grow, we have to make sure that we have enough to care for our primary constituents, that is our Blue Navy and our Green Marine Corps, our blue-green side. We have to make sure that we have the capability to make sure that we care for them at every juncture. Now, and I'm going to get out of this one by saying that CNO and Chief of Naval Operations and the Chief of Naval Personnel will be the ones that will determine our end strength, and they will determine mine too, but it will be based upon the capability that I, as the medical officer to the medical officer advisor to the CNO, will tell him that, sir, this is what I think the future holds for us, and this is what I think is a reasonable medical end strength to make sure that we have the capability of delivering force health protection to you and to the Commandant of the Marine Corps when you need it, where you need it, and how you need it.
Great. What does the future hold for Navy medicine? We will ask Vice Admiral Adam Robinson, Surgeon General of the U.S. Navy, to share with us when the conversation about management continues on the Business of Government Hour.